Johnson. But anyway, drove over and I came back on the ferry that night. Could hear, hardly hear a thing, because I think when I was so smart-ass kid, he gave me a helmet without any padding in it. I couldn't hear a damn thing. These pusher things right behind you. Yeah. Awful feeling. Anyway, the Joint Service Magazine was a contract by the Parker Brothers. And I remember I was the main inspector of that. We had one civilian. Usually there was a civilian inspector, sometimes a political appointment, usually one political appointment. Mm-hmm. And this guy, I remember his name was Hammersfield. Nice guy, but he was completely clumsy. He used to break more land transits by walking with the motor thing and turning the thing and hitting him on a tree. Anyway, then in late 38, they decided that they were going to build something for Prince Rupert. Almost all the coast defense construction things were cost plus contracts. Mm-hmm. The General Service Magazine wasn't, it was a fixed contract.
Were there any tests of that Prince Rupert at that time?
No, none at all. Mm-hmm. I'd been up on a reconnaissance with a team from Ottawa to locate the guns for York Island. Mm-hmm. And I was nominated to go as the inspector. And they decided, since we had to send an officer up there anyway, we might as well not have an extra inspector. So they did away with the political appointee. No, they couldn't get him if they wanted to go anyway.
I guess Prince Rupert wasn't exactly the cosmopolitan city that some might think it is today.
Actually, it was much more interesting. Mm-hmm. It was very isolated. It was a fascinating town. My wife comes from it.
Really?
Yeah. She went to school in Victoria, and then back in town for a short time, going to go away. And we met, and couldn't get married until the war broke out. But I was there.
Being a junior officer, you couldn't marry anyway, did you?
No, you couldn't. No.
Yeah.
Anyway, I got there on the first, I think the 9th of January, 39, and I stayed till May 40. And I'd only visited twice, once by my boss from Victoria and once by the boss from Ottawa. So it was really a very interesting thing. I learned a lot about engineering, because you had to keep abreast of what the hell was going on and pass all the payments. When the war broke out, they had to hustle things up, and I got a telephone call, start building accommodation. What do you mean accommodation? Build some buildings for the troops. What size? Well, the standard size, you ask. I don't have any plans up here. What do you mean the standard size? So anyway, they ran over the telephone and we started building it. I remember getting hell too for ordering the complete supply of shingles from a shingle mill. And they said, you can't do that. And I said, I not only have done it, but at least 3 barloads have been delivered. But it was great fun. Prince Rupert, you cut off, there's no road to it. Mm-hmm. You had to go in by boat. And it was nice. You got 3 boats a week or 4, 3 trains a week, and that was it.
Were there any other military personnel at Prince Rupert?
No.
You
there was a reserve unit there. I went up with one sergeant, and just the two of us in the garrison for when the war broke out, and then the commander of the local battery, old Sid Johnson, became the garrison commander, and I didn't even have my uniform in the damn war broke out. I had to send to Victoria for it.
You were civilians?
That's right, yeah. We're living in a lumber camp, and it was really quite fun. Anyway, as I say, I think I learned more or cemented more of my knowledge of engineering there than anywhere else, because there weren't too many other people. There was a young engineer for the contractor, and he and I would get our heads together and scratch and work out figures if we got into any problems, and we did, a lot of them. Mm-hmm. You'd have to rule the contractor that, no, we won't pay for that bulldozer just because you brought it in, you haven't used it yet. We don't pay it until you do use it, and just using it one day and then putting it away for a month won't do. Well, all sorts of fights in this way. Here, I'm a 24-year-old against these rather experienced engineers.
Well, did you have full authority to hire and fire and pay? Mm-hmm. So there weren't contracts signed in Ottawa.
No, the general contract was signed in Ottawa. Mm-hmm. That was a cost-plus contract. But there were a lot of other things that had to go on as soon as the war broke out. Building all the, we had a cost-plus contract going on all the time for 3 batteries. Mm-hmm. Three guns and another battery, contamination battery, across the on an island. But there were a lot of, that didn't include any of the accommodation. Now we added the accommodation on site for the batteries to that cost plus contract, because they were working there. I did on a day labor basis, the ones in town, took over an old hospital and refurbished that. This was all just straight day labor. Mm-hmm. And you'd have to hire supervisors locally. But it worked out very well. But mostly because the tradesmen in that area were just dying for work. They were getting, I think the carpenter's base rate in Vancouver was 70 cents an hour. And they would work for anything, but we paid them the 70 cents an hour.
So what was the population of Prince Rupert?
About 3,500. No, wait a minute. 7,000. And it went up to 15,000, back down to 17,000, now it's up to around 25 or 30,000.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the forecast is going to grow rapidly next little while.
Yeah, but you see, it had a shipyard, mm-hmm. which after the war they sold to Seattle, of all places. They had a floating dry dock.
Mm-hmm. Well, the intent was that it was going to perhaps even overshadow Vancouver as a...
Well, that was what Vancouver thought. Vancouver wouldn't let Prince Rupert do anything because it was a better harbor and it was closer to the Orient. It was meant to be the rail center, rail end terminal for the CN,
mm-hmm.
and I forgot the name of the guy who was the mentor. He was drowned on the Titanic. That's why Prince Rupert didn't get going, because that vision
went
down with him.
Yeah.
And personal push, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But God, they were selling when it was formed, building lots of 25 feet by 100 for $75,000. Of course, when after several depressions and things, they were worth about $2,000 or $3,000, and more often $200 or $300.
Yeah.
But it was a fascinating place, just fascinating.
Was there a large native population?
Not at all in town.
No.
They all lived outside.
Yeah.
Wasn't until the war that the natives came into town. There you'd see them in town, yes, but they were none lived in town.
Mm-hmm. Was there a reservation just outside?
Yes and no. There were some canneries. They lived in some of the cannery things, but most of them came in from a fair distance away to stop those sorts of places. The Morris River Indians did quite a bit of the cannery work. There were not too many Indians, mostly Japanese, in the boats. A lot of Norwegians and Swedes and that sort of stuff, of course.
You mentioned the Japanese. Would they live at Prince Rupert, or would they stay on the boats?
Mostly stay on the boats.
Yeah.
Mostly on the boats. There were some Japanese and Chinese in town, yes.
Mm-hmm. Were you told to keep a special eye on Japanese?
No, not really. The Navy were. When the war broke out, the Navy had a fairly senior naval guy came up and organized a fisherman's reserve,
mm-hmm.
and they rounded up the Japanese pretty damn quickly.
Yeah.
Pretty brutally, too. Japan hadn't come in when I left, so I didn't see very much of this, but I knew that we knew that there was a little suspicion of the Japanese, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, last
some of the local Japanese who ran the odd boat, you knew very well, and they were pretty straightforward individuals.
Mm-hmm.
You'd trust them in a boat just as much as anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't get as bad a hosing as they did here in Stevenson, in a collective way.
Mm-hmm.
See, there were up and down the coast, but they weren't in great groups, really. Anyway, the same sort of thing happened to the Germans. There were some Germans up there, too. Hugo Kroppner was the local dry cleaning guy. He took a beating.
Well, the reason I asked about Japanese is that last year I talked to an air marshal Dunlap who lives in
Victoria.
Yeah, and he told me that he was stationed a little bit before this in Queen Charlotte, and that it was common knowledge that the Japanese there were charting the coast.
Oh yes, we knew that. Yeah,
and that we had to keep a close eye on them. Nothing we could do. Just keep an eye on what they were doing.
Yeah, I was occasionally asked to keep an eye on the odd thing, but not. I don't remember anything very, very, very direct about it.
Yeah.
We all knew that they were probably the only ones that knew where the good harbors were.
Probably their charts were better.
Actually, the Norwegians and the other fishermen knew pretty well too. But there weren't nearly as many native fishermen as there are now.
Mm-hmm.
And they, They took over when the Japanese disappeared during the war. They took over quite a bit of the load of fishing. There were a lot of fishermen, but they weren't as well organized as they were.
Was it a case of the Canadian government or the British Columbia government giving them or selling them at a reduced rate, the boats that had been expropriated from the Japanese? Or
probably did. Many of the boats were property of the canneries rather than of the individuals, mm-hmm. and leased out.
But many of the canneries were owned by Japanese Canadians.
Were not many.
No.
I don't think there were any very few owned by Japanese Canadians. There were a lot of little independent ones that joined and sort of broke away from different groups. Mm-hmm. BC Packers took over most of them. Then there's a co-op. The McMillans had what's name, our old friends, we've known them for years. And they were the ones that did the most for looking after natives. Ewan McMillan probably was the strongest supporter they had for the native fishing. And even then, when he wanted to sell his thing to the natives to let them run it, then the government wouldn't do it, they would say, "Oh, I guess you voted the wrong way." And in fact, the one that they did on the Nass River had collapsed just the other day.
Shame.
Yes, it is.
Tell me, were there any problems with the native population, the kind that we have today with alcoholism or that kind of thing that we see here around Victoria and Sydney at Prince Rupert, or were they pretty strong, vibrant?
No, there were lots of, giving a drink to Indians was always a poor thing. They were, I'm not sure when I first realized that, but certainly I guess I've always thought of it, but realized that Indians and drinks don't mix very well.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, yeah, there were drunken Indians downtown occasionally, but not very often. They would be escorted out of Tom Reed pretty damn rapidly. Prince Rupert even had a red light district before the war.
Really?
Arranged by the fishermen. And they was property inspected.
I guess they'd
property.
Have to, because they'd have all these foreign fishing fleets on their doorstep.
Apparently the halibut fishermen wouldn't land their catch in Prince Rupert unless they had that sort of thing. It was very well done until the army thought they're much too moral to do, and they broke it up. Got completely disorganized, you know.
That's fascinating, it really is. When did the army move in? After you got out, I take it.
Well, the army started coming in right at the beginning of the war. A company of the Seaforth, no, a company of the 16th Canadian Scottish and a company of the Vancouver Irish.
Really, from
came up.
Victoria?
Yeah.
One of the Upper Island companies? Or
no, the ones from Victoria, I think. Anyway, a company came up of each of these, and they did some of the outposts and their sort of garrison duties. The local battery, 102nd Battery RCA, was a reserve unit there. It was mobilized.
Mm-hmm.
Signals and other people of this sort came in, signal detachment of some signal regiment in Vancouver came in. And I expanded my unit from two to four. And then when I left, it got another officer and a whole lot of other people. But it was interesting. We worked pretty hard.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going around Prince Rupert for, sometimes 4 or 5 days with pockets full of checks given to some of these drunken guys who, and going to the bar and make the guy sign his equipment roll if you could find him.
What were the amenities like at Prince Rupert at the time? Sports clubs or?
There was a good active sports activity run by the various social clubs in Prince Rupert.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, an awful lot of fishing and that sort of stuff, and hunting.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a thoroughly nice place to be. The sports activities were in competition with the terrace and places of this sort. Kilimat, of course, hadn't started. The Smithers and Terrace basketball teams would come in, high school bands would go in, and some of the native bands would, I'm talking about musical bands,
mm-hmm.
would play various ceremonies and this or something. It was quite a good deal of movement back and forth.
So who did the people predominantly be? Would it be English background, or would it be a mixture?
From the looks of the place, you'd think they were Scandinavian, but they weren't. The Scots and the English were the predominant. Quite a lot of them come out of the Yukon,
mm-hmm.
From the
gold
from the gold fields. Maxine's father had been up there, and that's where he, how he came. And quite an awful, a lot of these people, for instance, T.D. Platello, mm-hmm. Premier of the province, was Goldfish. Yeah, Goldfish was up there at one stage.
I know him as a bridge, mind you. I mean, he was Premier at one point, but he's a bridge now.
Anyway, he was an old friend of Magdalene's father.
What was her background, her father's background? Scottish?
No, German.
German.
They're both American. Both of them were Americans, and they came out of. He got up the gold fields and I pulled through Seattle. And when he came out, he went to Vancouver, and Kelly Douglas got him to go back up there, to open one of the some distribution system he had. And he liked it, so he bought out a jewelry business and became a jeweler. Much to his wife's horror.
Well, tell me, I don't know if it's personal, but were you courting your wife, your future wife, through the...
I met her about, March, I guess, of 39. Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. We were married in November 39. That's when all the regulations were permitted it. Even then, I had to sign a thing saying, if the war stops before you're a captain, you may have to go off the marriage roll. Not that there was a marriage roll in wartime anyway, they didn't, mm-hmm. But they did pay a portion of your money to your wife. Mm-hmm. I think you got $30 a month. Anyway, they didn't quit, so I didn't have to do that. Mm-hmm. Before the war, they had a marriage roll. A certain portion of people could be married. Other ranks, we were around 20% of privates, up to about 60% of sergeants, and in officers the same way, practically zero of lieutenants, and say 50% of captains and majors and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't draw any marriage allowance if they were all full. Mm-hmm. You might get permission to get married, but couldn't get on the marriage roll, which is kind of silly, but nevertheless, that's the way it ran. They had
money was short, and they wanted to the officers to maintain some level of standard of living that would be reflected.
The theory was, and quite correctly, that a young officer in particular wouldn't get to know his troops unless he went out and played all the sports with them and, mm-hmm. and was very active with them and with them a fairly substantial part of the day. And there was no 9-to-5 business at all. When I came out to Victoria, I was made sports officer almost immediately because I was the latest joint lieutenant. Latest arrived lieutenant, and then I became officer in charge of the rifle club, the garrison institute, and the sergeant's mess, and the officer's mess. I was the secretary of that, and I was an old fire marshal. Everything there was, it was one of these a tag on things. And I remember one of the very senior officers making a book of it. He said, "For God's sake, are you doing all these things?" Yes. Why? There were all these other guys go off to summer camp somewhere and they slough it off, and I pick it up and never get rid of it again. So anyway, it was quite fun, but they weren't very onerous, but I was the signing officer for most of these things. Hmm. I remember collecting, the sports thing was 10 cents per man per day, voluntary, which meant you got about 90 cents, not per day, per month, 90 cents a month. And the rifle one was very much the same. You get about 80 or 90, say $1.20. Per month than that. I remember putting one in one pocket and the other pocket and going down to the bank to put them in there. And then I got it mixed up. Then I said, oh hell, who the hell will know? Probably put the extra 30 cents in my own pocket, I don't know.
So when did you leave Christopher? In May, was it?
In May, about the 15th of May, I think it was. In
so you had 5 months of municipal marriage.
I went to Ottawa then.
Mm-hmm. Did your wife go with you?
I had a year and 5 months. Year and 3 months. Year and 5 months. Mm-hmm. This is May 40. It through from 39, right through all 39 to 40.
Mm-hmm. But you were married, what, November 39?
That's right.
So did your wife go with you to Ottawa?
Yes, she did. Yeah. Oh, we came down to Victoria, went through Victoria, and then to Ottawa.
What was your position in Ottawa?
I was a captain working on the design of coast defense construction. Mm-hmm.
West Coast construction or East Coast construction?
Well, they're all the same. They were standard design, but then you'd adapt them to site. I had went to Halifax twice, I guess, and I went to Gaspé We didn't do it on Gaspé, but we were looking for sites for putting these sorts of things. But we did. I did the installation of some of the guns in no, I guess it was the original planning of the construction of the location of Shabuktu Barracks and Shabuktu Battery in Halifax. Then there was some in Newfoundland, and several in St. John's, and in Sydney.
I take it the push was on for the East Coast, and the West Coast was not quite as
important. No, the West Coast had both, they really had only two significant ports.
Mm-hmm.
Three. We put some in on the entrance to Vancouver Harbour, but that was really not. The fact that the year before the war broke out, in September 37, 2 years before, when they had that first scare, I went over to put some guns in Stanley Park. They had the contractor on the ground when we were told to cease and desist. Fortunately, since Stanley Park was a military reserve, you didn't have to worry about it at all.
Mm-hmm.
The city was a little upset. They didn't realize it didn't belong to them.
By the way, I know this is interjecting one, but there was a book recently published called Vancouver Defended. Have you seen it?
No.
Well, it's by a BBC professor, Peter Moocht. I'm not sure of the pronunciation. But it details the Point Grey, and it's mostly the Vancouver around Stanley Park. It's quite interesting.
The Point Grey ones I worked on the design of, and the location. In fact, the first magazine, you know, these guns have a big solid piece of concrete and a very deep ammunition locker.
Mm-hmm.
It, quite big.
Mm-hmm.
Well down, well covered with burstures and things. There was a hell of a big spring right in the middle of the bloody thing. Actually, you put a board in, if you turned the tap on it, it was hit the van roof. What we did was tapped it and tapped it outside. Finally.
Well, tell me, when you were planning these batteries, would you have guns in mind? Were they obsolete guns from Britain?
Oh, you know, you knew what they were going to be. Yes, they had to be. Because the 6-inch guns and placement, there might be slightly different marks for 6-inch guns. Some of them were adapted naval guns, some of them were coast defense guns, and some were American guns we could pick up. I made a reconnaissance with my director, Norm Smith. He went down the west coast, and I went down the east coast of the United States, seeing the various places to find the naval guns to put into Petrie, I think, on the east coast. Anyway, we had to get then some accurate drawings of their foundations and elevations and this sort of stuff, so we could put them in properly. But the standard thing of the magazine on this side with an elevator coming up, the doors that open and close and this sort of stuff, were pretty well the same, because pretty nearly all 6-inch ammunition is about the same size. 9.2, mind you, is a different thing. That's quite a bit bigger and a lot heavier. Then you have a bit more track stuff, tapering this stuff after you get it out, putting it over onto the guns.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the next day, the first day, they're just open things. There were no cover over them at all. Then they realized that these guns could be badly strafed, so they had to put some covers on the tops of them. A great deal of fun trying to figure out what to put on there without making too heavy. Finally put concrete, reinforced concrete, then with about 2.5 to 3 inches of asphalt.
Mm-hmm.
With hard rock in it, and I remember at the National Research Council testing these things and find out what would go through a big bullet coming hit by a rock and it bends and would just not go through. These professors who were doing all the testing of these things were very interesting. They played around. They would do about one panel of the thing we'd got the specification of the Brits from.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would play around with glass balls and glass sheets and God knows what else. All of them worked a bit, but not as well as the hard flint that they'd specified. The reason, really, was the stuff that the British were using, and incidentally they put the same stuff around the bridges of merchant ships to stop strafing, or protect them from strafing. The stuff they specified was a very hard rock, not really very easy to find in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Could
they not find a replacement of something else?
Oh yes, we did. That's what most of this testing was about in that research. Getting something looked as though it would do, and finding out if it really would.
Mm-hmm.
But as you, as professors will, they played around with all sorts of other things, including marbles and glass balls. But marbles and glass balls did a pretty good job. They're sitting in a relatively plastic material, and they'd hit, and the rock would turn and turn the bullet. Mm-hmm. The glass plates and laminations didn't work very well, because mm-hmm. the second shot in the same place would go right through. Anyway, they were interesting to say.
Well, where would you get most of the guns from? Would it be a case that the Americans would be dealing?
The British Americans, we did have some. Mm-hmm. We had a few on each coast, and Halifax in particular had quite a lot. They had to be modernized. Most of the ones they had were these disappearing things.
Yes, the Fort Lauderdale.
They were terrible. I like the Fort Lauderdale ones, but some of them were even bigger. But anyway, we greased up the Lauderdale ones, and we used to run the searchlights from there, and it was quite an interesting little spot. Mm-hmm. Huge, huge wheeled, I think, one-lung diesel. And there was only one guy we could find that could get this thing going. This guy had retired some years before, and this dear old gentleman used to come down in his wing collar, and conservative collar, take his jacket off, his collar off, put on his overalls, and then he'd get some fellas to pull this bloody thing down, he'd bunk, bunk, with oil or some priming somewhere, and get it going. Nobody else could ever get the damn thing going. So every time we had the next slide, this dear old guy would come down and start it for us. Finally, they did replace it with more modern diesel. They're pretty hard to find.
Oh, yeah.
Quite adequate to do the job, but...
Is there any trouble stockpiling ammunition or getting ammunition for the guns? Or would that be your problem?
It was similar to the Navy type of thing. Not a lot of... I didn't see much of it, because I would disappear as soon as the proofing rounds had gone. I would disappear and go and do something else. Mm-hmm. Presumably they didn't. That's what all the Joint Service magazine in Colorado was for, put these things away. Mm-hmm. And I think that the most 6-inch things are interchangeable. Mm-hmm. That's why 6-inch was, and it's a naval gun as well as a coast defense gun.
But the guns
themselves are damn nearly the same thing, if mm-hmm. not exactly the same thing.
The reason I asked is because at that time I think it would be rather difficult for Canada to produce the weapons and the ammunition itself, and that she would be reliant upon out of the States.
I guess that's why we were going down the States primarily. Yeah. Yeah. The States were pretty good. We'd going down to visit these ammunition depots and armament depots. We had to get into civilian clothes. We couldn't go in Canadian uniform. Mm-hmm. They knew damn well we were in Canadian.
You could technically be interned, couldn't you?
Could be.
Yeah. That would be interesting, wouldn't it? Well, tell me, if we're on the West Coast here, and who was the perceived enemy, or potential enemy? Was it the Japanese, or was it the possibility of a German incursion?
German.
And that
Denver,
was the
German.
Technical, I mean, that was the official line.
That's right.
But in your own mind, was it the Japanese?
Yeah, well, it could easily be Japanese, or Russian, or anybody else. The point of the thing is that the only purpose of coast defense is to give us a secure base for military, primarily naval, mm-hmm. Ships, and of course merchant ships too. But that was accomplished. The Air Force rather had the idea they could have made a hell of a lot of airfields around and do the same thing. That's what Pat Bay was fighting for. Mm-hmm. But that really wasn't true. They can, and they can do a pretty good job if they have enough aircraft, but really, there haven't been too many people attack fixed defenses. It's not a very good risk.
Well, the military mind seems to think that if you go around it and avoid it and cut it off, like the Maginot Line, for example.
That's right. Well, that's why we put this one up in York Island, mm-hmm. so you couldn't go around it.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, I wouldn't say these were so terribly secure, but since none of the ships had any air potential at all, there isn't a damn thing to stop the submarine going right past these ships. But we knew very well that the Americans had some guns along their side of the shore too.
Mm-hmm.
And we also knew that they would be just about as surveillance minded as we would.
Yeah.
Because most enemy coming in were going to be just as unpleasant to them as to us. More so probably in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect they used to talk about Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Or the German threat. But they did have fairly free-ranging pocket battleship type things.
cut off the coast of South America.
Nice now.
Yeah. And the Scharn?
And the Scharnhorst.
Yeah.
They were the pocket battle ships. They had other ones, bigger ones too. The Bismarck was one. Anyway, the thing they were more afraid of were armed merchant ships.
Mm-hmm.
Which looked like an ordinary merchant ship, and then suddenly be able to blast the hell out of the naval base.
Were they called Q-ships, or...?
So the Q-ships was the name of the First War, I think.
Okay, yeah.
These are the ones that suddenly dropped things, and they became a fairly good battling, but some of the armed merchant ships didn't have much more than just one gun on them. Some of them had, you know, for protection. Some of them were really armed cruisers, and they were the Q-ships, as I know it. I don't really know.
It's funny,
but I think they're more afraid of those than anything else.
Yeah, it's funny, my father was a boy at the time, traveled out to the coast from Edmonton during the war, the early part of the war, and he said that they would mount guns on the CPR ferries, you know, for lack of naval ships, that guns would be mounted on anything that was on the water, simply to combat the problem.
Well, one of the cruisers we had, the Robert, was a CN ship.
Prince Robert, yeah.
Prince Robert.
Well, later she became a troop ship, didn't she?
Yeah, that's right. We didn't have very much. No. We're damn near in the same position now.
In fact,
if you really get down to it, Bennett's got a bigger fleet than the whole Canadian Navy.
Yeah, that's been said quite often. And there's a lot of truth to it. More modern? I mean, it's...
And operated by a lot of ex-Navy, too.
Yeah. A guard for one in Sydney, as a matter of fact.
Anyhow, the West Coast was very interesting. It was quite fun in a way. Every time there was any kind of a training exercise or training plan or some sort of acquisition of a training area, an engineer had to go along too, because we had to do the rental of the property or the arrangements of the property, and more particularly the paying for all the damage that comes with it.
Were people pretty good about that damage, or were they angry?
Yeah, fairly good.
They wouldn't take advantage of the situation.
Oh, sure, some did.
Okay.
Every time you'd fire off the coast defense guns, you'd find a half a dozen people want their house to be repaired. And we had a pretty good list of all the cracks they had in houses nearby. And said, no, that one you were claiming for before, we turned that down then.
Some experienced people.
There was an admiral close by. He used to bring help.
Well, sir, I'm very near the end of the tape, and would it be possible if I came back again and we could
sure.
find what to work?
Sure, yeah.
Fantastic. Sure.